Esther chapter 6 tonight, but we're going to do a little recap because I think Esther 5 really flows into it well. So while you're turning there, we'll do a slight recap. Also, just want to remind you, we are really going to be focusing on the fourth point tonight. God protects and saves his people as we are in the meat of the story. But a recap from last week to kind of catch us back up. Esther and Mordecai had several back and forth conversations where Esther wasn't excited about Mordecai's suggestions for her. And Mordecai essentially gave Esther an ultimatum that she was going to perish either way, by going before the king unannounced or by sitting on her hands and doing nothing. So Esther asked the Jews in Susa to feast for 3 days. And on the third day, she woke up, she goes before the king. But the king showed mercy. The king extended the golden scepter. So Esther invited the king and Haman to a banquet being thrown in her honor. And we feel like this is the moment that she's going to confront Haman. But she doesn't. She invites them back for a second banquet. But Haman's night was ruined when he saw Mordecai standing before him, not bowing, unwavering in defiance. And now Haman is on a war path for Mordecai and is going to the king to have Mordecai taken care of once for all. I'm going to read verse 13 of chapter 5, and then we'll roll into chapter 6. Haman's talking to his wife and his advisors, and he says, "Yet all this is worth nothing to me so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." Then his wife Zeresh and all her friends said to him, "Let a gallows 50 cubits, 75 feet high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast." And this idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. So that's where Haman's at. He's on his way to the king's palace. And let's pick up our story. Let's look at the first verse of chapter 6. "On that night, the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king." So if we remember, through 5 chapters, we covered a lot of time between chapters 1 up to this part of the story. 3 years between chapters 1 and 2. Several years have passed. Here, though, this is almost moment by moment. We have really slowed down our pace because we are in the middle of the story. We are in the plot line. Every detail is essential. And as we look at verse 1, we notice that on that night, so specifically the night that we just talked about in chapter 5, we read that the king could not sleep. Now, let's take a little dive. There's a thought here. The Hebrew author does not explain why King Ahasuerus couldn't sleep, although his choice of words is interesting. We read, "On that night the king could not sleep." Literally, the translation is, "The sleep of the king fled." And the Greek, again, this is kind of deep, but the Greek translation of that actually reads, "The Lord took the king's sleep." So we kind of read here, there's something afoot, there's something in play here with why the king could not sleep. And we know the king's moral character, the moral code is not great. He could have done anything to treat his sleeplessness. He could have distracted himself by any number of his wives or concubines. He could have done any sort of wine or partying, anything that he wanted to do. But we see another approach being taken. He wanted to hear the accomplishments and the record of his empire under his rule. Now, this is common for the kings, especially Persian kings, to keep records of their reign, and King Ahasuerus was no different. Whether this sleeping issue was common, sort of insomnia or whatever, or whether for some unknown reason his sleep was taken from him, he commanded that the book of records be read before him. Now, I'm curious, did anyone have kids who struggled to sleep, who just gave you fits trying to sleep? Tuttles, weren't any of you bad at sleeping? Chris is looking thoughtfully.
There were a lot of sleepless nights.
Oh dear.
It wasn't because they were just awake.
They were just awake, right.
You know, they were sick or something.
Yeah. I always slept well. Didn't I sleep well? Yeah, I slept well. I like that. Interesting.
I had trouble sleeping.
Did they? Yeah. Well, the bedtime story that King Ahasuerus chose to read himself, as he could not sleep, was his own accomplishments. What a guy. So in verse 2, "And it was found, as he's laying there, maybe in bed, I don't know what he's doing, someone is reading him the record. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Then the king said, 'Well, what honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?' The king's young men who attended him said, well, nothing has been done for him. So here we have two unexplainable coincidences. And of course, we know where we're going with this. First, of all nights, the king couldn't sleep. We can't really explain why he couldn't sleep. We're not sure. Second, upon his restlessness, one servant opened the book of records to the exact page recounting the act of Mordecai. Now, this is very common for Persian kings, especially, to want to reward loyalty. It does several things. It shows them that the king's a really nice guy. Second, it rewards them being loyal to him, and it encourages more people to be loyal for selfish reasons. Maybe I'll get something. History tells us that King Ahasuerus, King Xerxes, granted on one occasion, he gave a huge portion of land to two ship captains who had assisted the king in this great battle. Another one, a man was made governor of Cilicia, an entire province, for saving the life of King Ahasuerus' brother. So the king is not a stranger to doing great and wonderful things to people who help him out or show loyalty. But King Ahasuerus was unaware what was done for Mordecai. And when he researched what was done for him, well, it was nothing. Now, imagine Mordecai here, knowing that this is the king's pattern, saving the man's life. Maybe he's thinking, man, I wonder if the king will reward me. A couple weeks go by. Maybe he's forgotten about this. Finally, what a really great and thankful man this is. One commentator wrote, Mordecai had no doubt been keenly disappointed by this slight oversight of the king. His willingness to overlook and continue faithfully, though, gives insight into his character. As sort of a springboard from this, and we're going to have some interesting things that I'd love feedback here in a second. I read this week that when you feel you have been mistreated or that life isn't going the way you expect it to, take Mordecai, for instance, in those moments, do we believe that God is not in a hurry? And this was in reference to this exact part of Scripture. And I think we can kind of take that in life, realize God's in no rush with the plans that we have, the plans that we don't have, what he chooses to do in our lives or not. It was close now to 5 years since Mordecai saved the king's life. And he patiently kept living his life regardless of if the reward came or not. And actually worse than that, his enemy kind of got the promotion that he probably deserves. Mordecai was disappointed, but his character caused him to keep being faithful. And then Ahasuerus realized that he had failed to honor Mordecai. So he decided to repay that error immediately. Look with me in verse 4. And the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, "Haman is there, standing in the court." When the king said, "Let him come in." Now, pause for a second. This has been described as potentially the most humorous account in all of Scripture. Now, why is this so humorous, what we just read? Someone spell it out for us.
Well, Haman thinks he's going to go in and, you know, bring this idea to the king. And, oh, wow, he's awake early. He's even ushering me in. Oh, great. I'm just going to get this done. And it's just wonderful when he's faced with the reality of how he shall honor him.
Yeah. Just as Haman is storming into the king's court. Now, this is an act, think about this for a second. This is an act that Esther literally spent 3 nights fasting about, worrying about, asking all of the Jews to fast with her to go before the king unannounced and unasked. Haman, however, is storming into the king's court to bring his own plan to the king. Haman is not concerned about the king killing him. He thinks he's a rather important man, and he is. Just as that is happening, exactly what Chris just said, the king is now racking his mind for how to repay Mordecai. He asks who is in the court. Now, what time of day is it? It's night, it's late at night. Why is Haman there so early? We've touched on it, but why specifically do you think he was like, I need to go now? Couldn't this wait till later sometime?
Because the gallows were already being built.
They were being constructed right now. It shows something about Haman's priorities.
Excited.
Yeah, he definitely was excited. And I think also he wants this to be the king's first item of business for the day. Like, of all the things that the king of Persia probably could be worried about, he thinks that the king should be worried about his personal feud with Mordecai. Haman was on his way to meet the king
to discuss this murder. Now, at the time, he was making sure he was the first in line to see the king. There's no doubt no one else was there. Perhaps the king attendant met him on the way and brought him into the king's chambers. And Haman must have been even more excited now to take care of this business earlier than imagined. Let's take this care of verse 6. So Haman came in, and the king said to him, "What should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor?" And Haman said to himself, "Well, who would the king delight to honor more than me?" Now, this guy is a piece of work. Now, there's something interesting about the question. Do we notice anything unique about the king's question?
He wasn't specific about who to honor.
He wasn't, and he was vague. Now, there's some thoughts about maybe why he was vague and why maybe he just actually was genuinely just asking this question. But Haman didn't even have a chance to tell the king why he was there. The king asks, "What should be done for the man whom the king delights to honor?" One commentator thinks the king was wise in asking the counsel of Haman, for he expected Haman to explain how he himself would like to be honored. Maybe the king is familiar with Haman's proclivity to being prideful and arrogant and full of himself and thinks this guy will know how to treat himself if I ask him. Potentially, one commentator, actually the ESV Study Bible wrote, neither Ahasuerus nor Haman is aware of the heavy irony involved in the question. Now here, the specific wording, like I mentioned, of the king's question is the focus here. He says, what should be done to the man? Why do you think he didn't mention Mordecai, the king? Any thoughts?
He maybe knew
Haman didn't like him. Potentially.
We don't know if he even knew that Haman knew who Mordecai was, right? Yeah.
That's true. Or, I mean, at this point, maybe the king didn't even know who Mordecai was. If he forgot about him up to this point, maybe he did. Any other thoughts? Was it just maybe just an oversight? Yeah.
Even he knew that Mordecai was a Jew and he knew Haman and issued the order about the Jews.
I can't remember if I touch on this coming up. I think he does know that Mordecai is a Jew. And if not, that's going to be made clear to him in a bit. I think he does because of what he reads in it. Because later he's going to address him as Mordecai the Jew, I believe. So I think he knows now that he's a Jew. There's a potential that he's being cryptic. So look back with me in verse 3 real quick, and we're going to get slightly technical for a second, but it's kind of interesting. The question I read in my Bible is, what honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? This is what he's asking his guy who's reading the story. The word distinction means promotion. So naturally, what promotion has been given to this man because of what he did for me? The question he asks Haman is, what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? And again, this is probably one of those, it just so happened to be this way that we're going to get to time and time again in this story. Were the king to use the word promotion when Haman was already prompted, he might have asked some more probing questions because Haman's the second man in the kingdom. He's literally the right-hand man. However, by just referring to honoring someone, that allowed Haman to fill his suggestion with pride and conceit. So I don't know if the king meant to be cryptic about it. He apparently was, and Haman bit it hook, line, and sinker. Verse 7, let's keep going. And Haman said to the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honor," here we go, "let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head the royal crown is set. Let the robes and the horses be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" We'll pause there. This is quite a lengthy and incredible list of things, so let's walk with it slowly for a second. First, we see Haman repeating the king's words, and I'm imagining that he's trying to think on his feet as soon as he gets that question. So he goes, okay, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let," and then maybe he goes into it, I'm not really sure. I imagine that he is buying time or sort of empathizing with the king. Okay, listen up. This is what I think, so let me repeat it. One commentator wrote, "This seems to be the moment that Haman has been waiting for, literally his whole life. And by breaking off mid-sentence, he reaches a dramatic pause before he gets carried away and his suggestion pours out." The CSB Study Bible reads that Haman did not covet money or power. We assume he had those in great excess because he already had both. What he desired was the glory and splendor of royalty, including royal robes and a public parade. And that's specifically what he asked for. Haman asked for royal robes to be brought for the man, robes that were worn by the king himself. Now, that's pretty a gutsy request. And the horse that he asked was the king's horse. This horse would have worn a crest that had the royal crown on it. And some people read into this as well a little bit. To wear a robe that the king had worn and to ride on the horse that the king had ridden was the highest mark of honor that could be shown to a subject. For Haman, honor, what the king asked, how do I honor a man? For him, honor meant royalty. So it's not surprising that his suggestion includes so many references to the king, to royalty, that the reader almost gets tripped up on them. Now, if we were to dig a little deeper in this, how could we maybe read into Haman's request? Is there maybe something underlining that he could be getting at?
He wants to be king. I mean, actually, he has everything but that right now, is what I see. I mean, he's looking at, okay, well, I can't have any money, I want your clothes, I want to ride your horse, I want people to worship me like you, but I don't want any responsibility. You didn't say that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Anybody else? Do we agree? Do we concur?
He's just evil enough to maybe think about taking the king out himself one day, and this way the people have already seen him in the king's attire, and they would be more likely to go along with his plot.
I'm not really sure how out and about the king was in Susa, let alone the rest of the empire. Maybe they never saw him, and to see someone who was paraded around, as I'm just thinking about this right now, for them, that was as kingly as it got. All this amounts to something comparable to a bid for the throne, potentially. And it has been assumed that the end goal of Haman's ascension was the very throne of King Ahasuerus himself. Now, where did he suggest that this parade take place?
In the square of the city.
In the public square. Any specific reason why he chose there?
Probably the most crowded place.
And yes, probably because Mordecai was there.
This guy's quick, I'm telling you. Haman, you're also quick, Chip. That was good. The location of all this activity is in the open square of the city, suggests that Haman planned his finest moment to take place directly in front of Mordecai as he sat in front of the king's gate. It appears the old enmity has not been forgotten amidst this present enthusiasm. So it's not like he completely forgot about the reason he showed up there. This is actually just going to make it sweeter and sweeter. The thought of Mordecai embittered even the best moment of his life. And every moment is an opportunity to score a proverbial point. Now, as if the robes and the horse wasn't enough, the crowning moment would be that one of the king's chief officials would be leading Haman throughout the city, proclaiming, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." The ESV Bible Study Bible had a note that Haman's response shows both the extent of his vanity and his total unawareness of the trap that he's walking into. Like, just asking one more follow-up question probably would have caused him to go, "No, actually, don't honor Mordecai because of A, B, and C from his perspective. I'm actually here to have you kill him." He didn't do it. Haman arrived at the king's palace expecting to see Mordecai's death first thing in the morning. But this is even better. He will not only get to kill Mordecai, he will get to humiliate Mordecai before killing him. All this, again, remember, before that second banquet with the king and queen later that night. Could this get any better? Verse 10. The king loves this idea. "Then the king said to Haman, 'Hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew.'" That's why I believe he knew, obviously, because he describes him there. "Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned." In verse 11, we take a big jump here. So Haman took the robes, took the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Now, if the king knows of the enmity between Haman and Mordecai, he certainly doesn't let it show there. Thoughts about what Haman's reaction was?
Disbelief. Trisha, shaking your head.
He just had to be the worst moment of his life, one of the worst.
I'm wondering if like he like tried to change his advice for him, or like, actually, wait, maybe that's not what we should. At that point, the king it was too late.
Okay, do everything you said down to the letter. From Ahasuerus' point of view, this is interesting. Mordecai is no threat, obviously. He didn't even remember who he was. That he may have been more reluctant, perhaps, to accept this advice if Haman had been the object of his intentions. Again, I'm not sure whether the king looked at Haman and thought, I wonder if that guy's vying for my throne. I'm not really sure, but he loved this idea. So, now, something that we skipped over, which I really wish we wouldn't have skipped over, was a detailed account of that parade. That, to me, would have been just hysterical to read through. But our author does not describe the actual event. One commentator wrote, "The climax to this episode is recorded without reference to the thoughts or the feeling of Haman or Mordecai. Nothing needs to be said because the enmity and bitterness between them has already been established. The writer can trust the reader to read between the lines here." Now, I'm curious what Mordecai's response was as Haman maybe approaches him. Or did he bring guards? Did it look like, okay, this is the moment I'm about to die? And then Haman has to say, whatever. I don't know. We just have to think about it and be amazed in our imagination. For Haman, events begin to spin out of control here. The greatest honor Haman could imagine receiving was now bestowed on Mordecai the Jew, his enemy, whom he had planned to hang that day. Now, the humor that is obviously throughout this entire chapter clearly has deeper meanings. This isn't just a whoops moment for Haman, a temporary setback. This was a crushing blow that would take time to recover from, socially and politically. Now think about it for a second. How do you think the people of Susa thought about this entire getup? Because they know what that decree was recently. Any thoughts about maybe what the people thought as they're celebrating this guy, Mordecai?
Confusion, maybe. Just like us.
Yeah.
Well, maybe they're thinking the edict is void now because Mordecai's the Jew, and you're seeing him in the king's royal robes and stuff.
Which would be the first time that had ever happened for the king's edict to be made void. That would be definitely something to cause questions. Yeah. I mean, they have no idea what's happened up to this point, but they know that this guy, Mordecai, is a Jew. And apparently Haman, who didn't like him, is now honoring him. Oh, well, this entire thing happens. What a day this must have been for Mordecai, for Haman. I don't think awkward is maybe the word we should use here, but just unbelievable that what just happened. And then in verse 12, "Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate after it's all over. But Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh told him, 'If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fail, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him.'" Well, this is comforting. This is what Haman wants to hear after one of the worst days of his life. Now, obviously, we know that covering the head symbolized grief. So Haman is publicly showing people his distress. In the meantime, Mordecai returned to the king's gate. Both of these men, I find this interesting, and I'd love maybe some thoughts on this. For all of their mutual disgust, all of their hatred for one another, they returned to their normal lives following this great parade. Haman went back to his amazing home with all his friends and advisors. Mordecai went back to the gate. We have no reason to believe that Mordecai was motivated by selfish ambition like Haman would have been. But if Haman would have been looking at the parade for some sort of fulfillment in life, it would have only been a fleeting joy. I think about maybe sometimes as Christians and people in the world, unsaved completely, just like saved, unfortunately, how often do we put all of our emotions, all of our focus on some peripheral event, some item, anything, you fill in the blank, and allow it to consume us as if that will ultimately satisfy the longings of our heart. There's a really pithy quote about the human heart. Does anyone have it in their mind? It's about longing and the human heart. It's been said that each of us has a God-shaped hole in our hearts. Now, while this is kind of a cute, pithy saying, and I probably wouldn't feel comfortable saying that out loud as something that's very serious, there's maybe some merit to it. So slightly off topic here. Someone, a couple people in a couple sentences, why were we created? That's a big question.
To love God.
To love God. Amen. Anybody else?
Glorify God.
Glorify God. Is that Jesus?
Reflect it.
Ooh. Reflect what about?
Who he is, his character.
That's good. Anybody else?
Serve him.
To serve him, yeah. Mm-hmm. One thing that maybe wasn't mentioned is that we were created to enjoy fellowshipping with our Creator. Was that not what Adam and Eve looked forward to every single day, walking with God in the garden? And is it any wonder that pursuits outside of God's plan always leave us wanting more? I think it's something that we can specifically apply to our lives. Haman here was motivated always, ever, and only by his own pride and his own selfishness. I pray that that would never be the story of our lives, or even just a brief chapter of the story in our lives. In verse 13, Haman here is complaining again to his wife, Zeresh, and the men, these wise men, or friends, as they're called in the previous chapter, about this entire situation. And while the first meeting of the minds produced a good idea to murder Mordecai more quickly, this second meeting, it almost turns prophetic. Again, let's read what they said in verse 13. After Haman told his wife, told all these people, then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordecai before whom you have begun to fall is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. A commentator wrote, this, their statement is both a gloomy prognosis for Haman and a reluctant recognition of the surviving quality of the Jewish people. Though his confidants are described as friends, their advice is anything but friendly. Now, why reference the Jewish people as a whole? It's like they go, if this Mordecai is of the Jewish people, then their end goal is what they said at the end of their sentence. Why do you think that they kind of viewed the Jewish people as a whole here?
It's their first reaction.
Do we think that they think that these Jews are special or something? Renee's on your head.
They're winners. In history, the Jews are winners.
Yeah. And it's interesting that they were able to come up with that when what do we know about the Jews up to this point of the story, at least, from what we've been told?
They're accepting their demise.
Accepting their demise and... Are their lives necessarily characterized by what is to be true and unique about the Jewish people? Not really. Like I've mentioned before, they're celebrating, they're having parties, they're marrying Gentiles, they're not living Torah live. But I find it interesting here that these wise men, they go, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. Do we think these people knew the Jewish history?
Yeah. I'm going to give a very different view for a minute. You call them the wise men. These are not the magi. These are his friends and advisors,
yeah.
All right? Anybody wise probably got away from him when you think about it, right? Now, and actually, after reading that, it made me go back to the end of chapter 5, and it made me look at that a little differently. Now, think about who knows him the best. His wife and his friends and advisors, okay? And they just had a meal with him, and they had to listen to him brag and everything, and then he complained about one thing, yet everything, he complains about this one guy. And so, could it have been, it doesn't say it's sarcasm, but it's absurd what his wife says. Oh, build a gallows of 75 feet, and then go ask the king if you can kill him. And he went, yeah, oh, that's a great idea. Could she have been like, I'm sick of you, buddy. Why don't you do this? And then he comes home, and she's such a comfort to him. Right? Jesus had the worst day of his life, and instead of saying, "Oh, I'm so sorry," and we're all in trouble now, she doesn't even think of herself. She's saying she just piles on coals on his burning fire and says, "Oh man, you're in trouble, bud." I don't know. That just went through my mind. Now you can ignore me. Go on to the real truth.
I was gonna say reaction to that. That was good. Anybody?
I think you've got the other truth of his friends too. I mean, they listened to him tell how important he was, so they knew how much power he had. And then they said, "This is just one little guy that's causing a problem for you. Get rid of him." And then they knew he had this whole plot to get rid of him. And then they watched him running through the streets, telling everybody how wonderful this guy that he was supposed to be getting rid of was.
Right.
And I think they're just looking from just a fatalistic standpoint and saying, "If that's the way it's running, you're in trouble."
Right.
It's not going your way.
Right. I assume Haman probably didn't go home and tell them before he went to see Mordecai. So literally, like, the next conversation after this guy's supposed to be dead is actually just Haman leading him through the streets. I like that trip a lot. That's a really good perspective. And again, here, it's funny to me that these wise men, as they're called, and again, they're anything but, I would agree, at least from a Jewish perspective, they know the history of the Jewish people. And I mean, it's not uncommon to hear about this tiny little country, this tiny little place who is, you know, winning great battles, defeating the Canaanites, driving out people from their land. There's something unique about this. And if Mordecai is already beginning to win over the fate of Haman, well, they're not tying themselves to Haman, it would appear. Though these secularized Jews were not up to date on the law, it was known about the great stories of the Jewish people, and these Persian wise men can see the handwriting on the wall, which I thought is an extremely appropriate reference, being that we're in Persia. So, a commentator wrote, "The advisors in Hebrew, Chip here, is called wise men. That may be ironic because they were only wise after Haman started to fall. Earlier, they advised him to make the gallows for Mordecai," what Pastor was saying. "They also may have been aware of the revival of the Jewish people since the time of Cyrus, as they were growing in numbers. If they were sensitive to the signs of the times, perhaps they were aware that divine providence was responsible for the Jews' protection time and time again." Again, we're not sure, but it is ironic to me that everyone apparently but the Jews, at least recorded for us, has a propensity to give credit to the rich Jewish history and their God as a force to be reckoned with. Again, a note from one of the study Bibles that I consulted. "Even Haman's wife and advisors sense that an irresistible power or a person seems to protect the Jewish people. And if Haman, this powerful man, is already beginning to fail, there's probably no hope for him." Verse 14, "While they were yet talking with him," again, this is moment by moment, "the king's eunuchs arrive and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared." So again, he was supposed to be a lot more excited going into this than he was. To say that this day did not go the way Haman had planned would be quite an understatement. His day began with him excitedly going to the palace to have Mordecai murdered on the gallows which were currently being constructed down the street. And it all went downhill there. Now, amidst this wonderful advice that he is receiving from his wife and advisors, there's a knock at the door, and it's the king's eunuchs arriving to bring him to the banquet. And a little note here, Haman thought he would have a happier banquet this day if he could destroy Mordecai. But now he must have gone to the banquet with fear. The words of his wife, "before whom your downfall has started," must have been ringing in his ears. And so for the first time for us as the reader, this hopeless situation, and it really was, it was hopeless, we begin to see maybe there's a glimmer of hope for our people. Now, I'm going to summarize where our four main characters are at this point of the story. Obviously, we're done with our chapter. King Ahasuerus, he began with a ridiculous feast lasting 6 months, deposed his wife, surrounded himself with poor advisors, topped it all off by promoting Haman to a place of immense importance. He signed a royal edict calling for the destruction of every Jew in the Persian Empire on the 13th of Adar.
the month of Adar. Meantime, was reminded that he had not rewarded Mordecai, the Jew, for saving his life, and made Haman do that. That's King Ahasuerus' story. Haman, an Agagite, the fierce enemy of the Jewish people, promoted to the king's right hand and had immense influence over the people of Persia, and used that authority to enact revenge against the Jews. Now, unfortunately, in the middle of this plan being completed, the king threw a massive wrench in his plan by making Haman parade Mordecai around the city of Persia and honor him. Now to our Jews. Mordecai lived a quiet life in the city of Susa, sitting at the king's gate in some minor official position, raised his orphaned young cousin as his own child, saved the king's life upon hearing about an assassination attempt, and was sent reeling at the news that the Jewish people were to be slaughtered in 11 months at the hands of their Persian neighbors, but was unexpectedly honored by Haman, his enemy, in a royal parade. But no doubt, this only brought a brief distraction to the certain doom awaiting him. Again, this probably couldn't be enjoyed by Mordecai, could it? Knowing what was coming, maybe. And then finally, Esther, who doesn't show up in chapter 6. Esther, an orphaned Jewish girl raised by her cousin, who was selected to participate in an empire-wide queen selection, won the favor of her supervisors, of her peers, and most importantly, the king himself, who promoted her to queen right on the spot. Following troubling news from Mordecai, she risked her life to go before the king unannounced to invite him and Haman to a banquet, and now prepares a second banquet with the intention of confronting the wicked Haman. Now, why did I do that? Look with me on the screen here. You're going to see this is a resource that I pulled from the Bible Project. We're going to begin to see these characters go through. Again, we see up here where we began our story. We're going to kind of walk through this. So the king's person, his greatness. We see here in chapter 3 that Haman is elevated. Mordecai is not pleased with this. Haman decreed to kill the Jews. Remember, he rolls the dice here and picks this day, this banquet, this celebration. He goes to this banquet of the queen and on his way builds this massive gallows for which to impale his enemy. And then tonight, we came here, the story pivots, and we see the unhappy Haman leading Mordecai through the streets. Now, as you can see, and of course, there's a lot of information up there, but as you can see, we've kind of gone down in a U, and we're going to begin to tick upward as the story kind of does this great reversal. Where our characters are at, or at the beginning, are going to be very different from where we find them at the end. And that's interesting, because this idea of a divine reversal, it's in full swing now by chapter 6, and Haman is walking to the banquet of Esther, thinking that he is in control of every aspect just that morning, but there seems to be something confusing his plans. One final quote, and then we'll kind of wrap up for tonight. Now Haman has no control over the circumstances or the coincidences, and he is summoned by the eunuchs in just the same way that Vashti was summoned before she disappeared from the royal court. As Haman arrives, harassed mentally and in his remembrance of what happened that day, Esther now assumes control. So there was a lot of reading into it behind the scenes. So let's look for God in our story tonight. Where do we see God showing up?
First, whenever the king can't sleep, and goes straight to the
king can't sleep, absolutely. Anywhere else?
It's no coincidence. So when the king looks up and says, "Who's out in court?" You read scripture and almost matter-of-factly says, "And Haman's walking in."
Yeah.
But God orchestrated all that so that Haman could start his own doom all by himself.
Yeah. Anywhere else?
Well, and when he couldn't sleep, what he wanted to read from and where they turned to, right where Mordecai saved him.
I imagine this like massive book, like across the page, and then, oh, all right, let's start reading here. Yeah, absolutely. Anything else? There's one that I thought of.
The ambiguity of the king's request to Haman.
Yeah, just rewording that just one little bit could have maybe caused some alarm. Again, promotion, we talked about that, but no, Haman just goes into this big speech. Yeah, God is all through this story. And again, he's not mentioned because we're supposed to look for him.
And that story, that's so exciting, chapter 6. And now as we get towards the end of our story, chapter 7 through the rest of it, it's really going to pick up quickly here. God's actions are really going to come to the scene. But before we get some final comments and kind of conclude, we've talked about the whole time why Jesus is better than everything, and this is our list. It's growing. So now I'm going to ask three specific questions, and I'd love some feedback. Compared to the king, why is Jesus better from our story today, chapter 6?
He knows all things.
Ooh, Charles, that's good. He knows all things. Anybody else?
He never forgets. Right. And then, you know, doesn't take care of something that should have been taken care of. Mm-hmm.
Compared to Haman from chapter 6, how is Jesus better?
He's humble.
He is humble, and he proved that to us, yes. Anybody else?
He brings life, he doesn't take it.
That's good. Brings life. Can I write creates life?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Anyone else? One more category. Yeah, Lucy.
Kind of going along with him, though, he was about bringing glory to the Lord, not about, like, Haman was full of, like, self-glory,
mm-hmm.
I guess, which is because Jesus is God, so that would be right for him. But, you know what I'm saying?
The Son glorifies the Father. Mm-hmm. Through his actions, and he did that all the time for his life. Not my will, but thine be done. Exactly right. Finally, compared to Haman's wife and his advisors, how is Jesus better than them? Charles is laughing. Anybody? Just shout it out.
He brings hope.
Yeah.
We can trust his advice.
Specifically through
his wise counsel.
Oh, perfect counsel, right?
Yeah, it's perfect counsel.
Anyone else?
Faithful.
Yeah. That's good. All right, and as we conclude, before we go to a short time of prayer, a seemingly inconsequential night of restlessness, that should be the end of it, yeah, results in deliverance for God's people as Ahasuerus is reminded of Mordecai's faithfulness, and Haman, who has constructed gallows on which to kill Mordecai, is forced to exalt him instead. Previously in Israel's history, God has used mighty miracles to deliver his people and to fulfill his promises. Think of the Red Sea. Think of all these amazing ways. In this story of Esther, God was using the ordinary events of life to realize his covenant promise to his people. He used even seemingly insignificant events, such as the king's sleepless nights and the decisions of less than perfect people, to fulfill, nevertheless, the promises of his ancient covenant with his people. There's two gospel reminders embedded in this story tonight. First, we see once more that God is working behind the scenes for the good of his people. The king just happened to have a sleepless night and just happened to hear of Mordecai saving the king. And second, we remember that God humbles those who exalt themselves, yet he delights to exalt those who humble themselves. The supreme example of this upside-down principle is Christ Jesus himself, as was mentioned tonight. Any closing comments? Yes?
Jesus is the only one deserving of the royal robes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, he didn't claim royal robes, did he, when he came? No, not at all. I will close in prayer. In the past, you can come up. Father, we do thank you for this night. Thank you for chapter 6. Thank you that your hand is throughout all of this, and we're excited to see more about what you do to preserve the Jews next week. Thank you for people who came out tonight. We do pray for our church as we go into a time of prayer. We will trust you for the outcome, and we thank you specifically, ultimately, for what Jesus Christ did for us on the cross by saving us from our sin. And we live to make much of you and make much of him through our lives. In your name I pray. Amen.